Hello, this is the podcast for this evening's class, Monday, August 23rd, and I'm considering this class number one because our first class was really orientation, and now we're getting into very much the substance of tort law, and I wanted to start by giving you background in torts. Why is torts distinguishable from criminal law? Why is it distinguishable from contracts? What makes it particularly relevant or particularly nuanced for legal practice? And why negligence is a particularly American concept. Certainly negligence laws and negligence lawyers are everywhere around the world, but it's very much of an American concept. And negligence itself is really a very new part of the law. It was brought around by the made necessary by the Industrial Revolution, as I said. Big industry meant big injuries, and up until that time, strict liability was really the norm. There weren't that many injuries, and they weren't that serious. So having somebody who caused an injury always have to be responsible for it was not that burdensome. After the Industrial Revolution, however, negligence became more the norm because it was too burdensome to always be paying for injuries. Negligence means that there's not always going to be compensation for a serious injury. Compensation only arises if the court determines there's fault. In our negligence system, fault is based on risk. Too much risk, unreasonable risk, means a legal conclusion of fault or responsibility. Liability for your actions only comes after your actions have been determined to be unreasonably risky. So again, tort negligence law, our negligence system, means that not all injuries, even though they may be serious ones, receive compensation. The goal, of course, of our tort system is compensation, being made whole, and deterrence. Torts is a system that's based on standards rather than rules. Criminal law, contracts, very rule-based. Civil procedure, totally rules. But torts is a system where based on standards and we're easily adapted to a wide range of circumstances. In torts, facts are what drive the case. Facts are the most important thing. Of course, we have to have the law. The judge determines what the law is, instructs the jury on the law, and the jury then takes the facts and applies them to that, the law that was part of the jury instruction. So we saw, remember, in Hammondtree v. Jenner, the issue there was the jury instruction itself. Plaintiff wanted a different jury instruction. The jury instruction is what sets out the law. And then the jury can take the facts that are presented in during the case and apply them to the law to reach their conclusion. But in torts, the facts really drive the case. So one injury can be an identical injury one day, same injury the next day, different results depending on different facts. If your facts are strong enough, course, the jury is going to come up with their conclusion. During the course of a tort case, however, the plaintiff has to move the case forward. The defendant has to try to stop the case. There are a variety of motions that are available to stop the case from getting the jury. Motion to dismiss is brought by the defendant to say that there's no legal claim. There's no legal authority for this action. There's no law that's been broken here. There's no legal authority. So motion for summary judgment means that no reasonable jury. There are either insufficient facts to support the plaintiff's claim, or no reasonable jury could take the facts that were given and come up with a different conclusion. So motion for summary judgment questions the sufficiency of the facts. Motion to dismiss questions the legal claim. Both are designed to keep the case from the jury. When the jury does get a case, the burden of proof is a rather low one, just preponderance of the evidence, 51%, as opposed to the criminal law burden of proof, which is beyond a reasonable doubt. So the idea that criminal law has a much higher burden of proof, we discussed, maybe because the penalties are much more significant, not just penalties in the short run, but penalties in the long run. Before getting on to the real meat of the negligence case, the elements of a negligence case, we are going to spend some time talking about vicarious liability. And all vicarious liability is a way to be held liable for the torts of another. We always say you're liable for your own torts. You're responsible for your own injury. So even children, you don't sue their parents. You sue the child if they're of an age. Everyone is responsible for the torts that they themselves, the injuries they themselves cause. But under certain circumstances, you can be held liable for injuries caused by another, and that's our system of vicarious liability. So we spend a little bit of time talking about a pocket of strict liability in negligence, and that's vicarious liability. First case we talked about was the Christensen v. Swenson case. There, the important thing to note is, is the employer going to be held responsible for the injuries caused by the employee under the theory of respondeat superior? And the legal theory for respondeat superior is that you're held liable for torts committed by your employee if those torts were committed during the scope of employment. So the classic term here is, was the injury that Swenson caused off the premises of the employer still within the scope of employment? Certainly the premises itself is not absolutely key, because suppose you're a delivery, you deliver bread, you hit somebody on your bread route, you're not on the bread, you're not at the bakery, you're out in the world, but it's in the scope of employment. So the geography isn't always the determining factor. Here the court uses as authority the Berkner case,